You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Congressional Budget Office released a latest report on the federal deficit, and it's big. We'll talk to an economist about what's in that report and how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the U.S. economy. First, gun sales in the U.S. are seeing a major spike this year, according to commonly used data. Over the course of the spring and summer, several million more firearms have been sold in 2020 compared to the same time period last year. The CEO of one gun maker, Smith & Wesson, told shareholders last week that the demand the company was seeing this year was in some ways unprecedented. An initial jump in sales happened when the coronavirus outbreak started, and it continued during nationwide protests and counter-protests over racial injustice and policing. People have been shot and killed in some of those demonstrations, including here in Wisconsin. Timothy Litton is a professor of law at Georgia State University's College of Law. His books include Suing the Gun Industry, A Battle at the Crossroads of Gun Control and Mass Torts. Timothy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be with you, Rob.
Well, I know there's not exactly one-for-one data on gun sales here, but based on what we see out there, how significant a spike in firearm sales are we seeing?
We've seen sustained rises in firearm sales starting way back in January of 2020. In January of 2020, sales were up 25% from 2019 at the same time. February, that went up to 36% from 2019 at the same time, and we saw those increases going on all through the summer. In August of 2020, there was a 58% increase from 2019. This is for both handguns and long guns. And 2020 sales now are about 15 million weapons, which now exceeds the total for 2019. So in the first three quarters of this year, we've exceeded the total sales for firearms from last year.
Does this match up with past events? Are there common things that seem to lead to increases in gun sales like this?
I think these spikes are a little bit different than what we've seen before. The gun industry is a little bit unusual. In most industries, if there's some major disaster associated with the industry, whether it's the food industry and foodborne illness outbreaks, or it's the appliance industry and there's some sort of fire, industries do very poorly when there are disasters associated with their products. The opposite tends to be true in the firearms industry. We see spikes in firearm sales in the wakes of mass shootings. So every time there's a mass shooting, whether it's in Sandy Hook or it's in Parkland in Florida, any of these mass shootings are usually accompanied in the aftermath by a spike in gun sales. And the reason for that is that many gun owners are fearful in the wake of mass shootings that there'll be a political reaction to increase restrictions on firearm sales. And so they tend to go out and buy more firearms. So it's kind of countercyclical if you think about it. That has not been the case with the spikes that we've been seeing recently. The spikes that we're seeing recently aren't associated with disasters associated with firearms like mass shootings. They're associated, as you mentioned at the front of the segment, with the pandemic and protests and urban unrest and increasing uncertainty about the economic future as the pandemic continues. There are also, I think, some increased fears about crime that are associated both with economic uncertainty and the unrest we've seen in many cities.
Do we have a precedent for this kind of thing? I know we haven't seen anything like COVID-19 for, like a century, so there may not be a lot of data to match up there.
Well, as I mentioned before, in the wake of mass shootings and also when people are worried that there are going to be elected leaders who are likely to favor gun control, there tend to be increases in sales. And there are spikes after mass shootings generally in the last decade or so. But this idea of sort of a sustained set of spikes month by month over the course of a year does seem to be relatively new. And I think it's the convergence of these various pressures, the pandemic, protests and urban unrest, and economic uncertainty that have really all come together in almost the perfect storm. There has been over the last 3 years what they call the Trump slump in the firearms industry. Because there's been less fear about gun control with the election of Donald Trump as president, there have been fewer people going out to purchase more weapons in order to make sure that they have, weapons available if they want them, because they're just not worried about future restrictions. So this has really been a turnaround for the gun industry in the last year.
Is there any way to tell from available data, Timothy, whether this is a case of people who already own guns going out to buy more guns or a growth in first-time gun ownership?
We know anecdotally, and this is largely from press reports and interviews and going out and talking to people who operate gun stores, that this is a mix of first-time buyers and repeat buyers. There are people coming to stores for the first time who've never purchased a firearm, who've been motivated to do so by the current climate. And there are also many people who already have a small arsenal of firearms who are just stocking up on more, which is also a relatively common pattern. I think there's a increase in the number of first-time buyers that's somewhat unusual in the current situation.
Talking to Timothy Litton, professor of law at Georgia State University, looking at a big increase in gun sales in 2020, month after month. We see big increases compared to the previous year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you, if you're willing to share your story, have you bought a firearm this year? Was it your first ever or a new one in your collection? What led you to make the decision to do that and do that when you did it? Call in at 800-642-1234. Timothy, are there concerns with safety, more firearms being out there, maybe leading to more household firearm accidents, more risk of suicide, that kind of thing?
I think there's always a fear about lack of training when there's a large spike in the number of first-time purchasers. And that's something that's occurring now. A lot of first-time purchasers have no experience with guns. They're buying them, you know, in a relatively short span of time. There are a lot of them purchasing them. And as a result, there are some worries that they may not be receiving the training for handling and storing those weapons that they should. And that's likely to give rise to an increase in firearms accidents and possibly suicides as well.
I've seen a concern that, hey, if this is a time when we're not doing activities in person, that first-time gun buyer may not be going to take that firearms training in person because of the pandemic. Is that part of the concern here?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. You know, a lot of places where you can get firearms training are associated with the gun stores where you purchase the weapons, and they tend to also be social places. And it's very difficult at a firing range to maintain social distancing and masks, and people who may be worried about that may be reticent to show up to get the training that they would normally otherwise get if they were first-time firearms purchasers.
As I mentioned earlier, Smith & Wesson reported big sales, and in their press release, they talked about how they were able to ramp up production to keep up with demand. Is that something that that's been true across the firearms industry, or have there, as far as you know, have there been shortages of certain types of firearms if companies and stores couldn't keep up?
I'm not aware of a lot of shortages in the United States. I think the domestic market has largely been well supplied, although that's with the exception of the Remington Corporation. Remington, which is a longtime gun manufacturer, has been having financial troubles and went into bankruptcy. They couldn't keep up with the supply chain. That was related to a variety of legal problems. But in the United States, I think there's a relatively robust supply of new firearms. I have been told, however, that in Canada, with the advent of hunting season, there have been increasing shortages along the supply line for supplying firearms to Canada. And I think that a lot of foreign buyers are seeing this shortage as a result of the spike of sales in the United States domestically.
Taking a longer view, have you seen much progress made in either direction when it comes to gun laws, loosening up regulations or stronger support of the Second Amendment, depending on how you look at it, or new gun laws at local or state levels?
This is an area in American politics where people tend to get increasingly entrenched wherever they start. So we see very often in the aftermath of mass shooting events where people's minds are very much on firearms and firearms policy, that in states where majorities of people tend to favor gun control, we see additional controls put in place, restrictions on sales or certain types of weapons. And in states where the majority of people tend to favor liberalization of gun rights, the response to mass shootings often is liberalization of your ability to carry a weapon, either concealed or openly. And so it really comes down to where states are already, and they tend to just get more entrenched wherever they start in the aftermath. So I don't think we're likely to see many changes other than, you know, increasing extremes in terms of restrictions in some states and liberalization in others.
We're talking to Timothy Litton right now, professor of law at Georgia State University, expert on the firearms industry. We're talking about a spike in gun sales in 2020. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you bought a firearm this year yourself? If so, if you care to share, what was your motivation? Were you already a gun owner? Is this your first time? Do you have concerns about an increasing number of guns in an already gun-rich country? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Timothy Litton, professor of law at Georgia State University, author of the book Suing the Gun Industry, looking at the rise in gun sales we've seen in the United States this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you one of the many Americans who's purchased a firearm this year? Do you want to call in and tell us what led you to make that decision to make it in 2020, first time or another in your collection? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Oregon. Jacob, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Jacob?
I just wanted to say that I haven't bought any new guns because I have enough, but it makes sense to me why people are going out to get guns because of the whole talk about defunding police and all that. So kind of I think it's leading people to think that they're going to have to police their own streets if they're going to move forward with getting rid of police.
Jacob, thanks a lot for the call. And I think that's one common possible motivation, Timothy, that people are worried with criticism of the police. No actual defunding really of the police anywhere at this point, but the concern over what might happen in the future.
I think that's right. One thing that's interesting about firearm sales is that, like many products, they're fueled by different kinds of narratives or stories that people tell themselves or that they believe in. And I think typically, you know, many people who purchase multiple firearms purchase them because they're really concerned about personal liberty. They believe very strongly that the right to private firearms ownership is a central feature of American liberty, and it's part of what keeps the country free and protects us against tyranny. And so they're mostly worried about big government, and they're people who oppose big government. And because they oppose big government, they tend to, you know, believe that it's useful to have a lot of privately owned firearms. Here we're talking about an opposite kind of narrative where people are worried about small government. In other words, the shrinking of government, the defunding of the police, the idea that there's going to be anarchy because the government's actually not playing a robust enough role. And because of that, they're going out to purchase more firearms. So there are these two almost opposite narratives, you know, one about big government and the need to purchase firearms in order to protect ourselves against big government, and another about small government and the shrinking of the government and the need to protect ourselves in an age of anarchy if we don't have adequate first responders and police services. And so I think both of these things are actually fueling firearm sales in the United States. And I think the caller is absolutely right that this worry about defunding the police and fears of anarchy have been part of this story this year.
Thanks for that call, Jacob. We'll go to John now in La Crosse. John, hello.
Yes, I was just wondering if there is a, during the purchase of these weapons, is there a tally on who's buying them in terms of race? And is this a white issue of buying weapons? I've been around for many years, and whenever there's a conflict, a social conflict, it seems like there's a outpouring of wanting to buy weapons and using that as a solution instead of an intellectual one. We have thousands and thousands of universities and people of intelligence that we can't come to a social issue that we have to get involved with weapons in order to destroy one another. And
I gotcha. A couple different points there. First of all, are we able to track the demographics, I guess, of who is buying guns, Timothy?
We don't have global data on this. This is not the kind of information that's tracked in background checks, but we do have anecdotal evidence that certainly starting in the summer that increases in firearms purchases were, you know, among people of a variety of different races. It's not just a white phenomenon. Even during the beginning of the pandemic, you know, here in Georgia, there were interviews in the local newspapers. There were people of all different, you know, ethnic and racial backgrounds worried about the withdrawal of essential services during the pandemic and the overtaxing of first responders. And they were feeling a lot of insecurity, and they went out and purchased firearms. I think that traditionally, one often sees the NRA and the firearms lobby and gun rights advocates as a predominantly white movement. And it's certainly, you know, that's part of its brand in some ways. But I think that the current firearms sales and the industry's attitude is much broader than that. And the industry's happy to sell firearms to pretty much anybody who wants to purchase them. And they market, you know, very broadly. So I don't think it's a phenomenon of one race alone.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Gwen with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. I bought my first gun this year, kind of as a 65th birthday present for myself, long before there were the riots, civil unrest, whatever you want to call the protests. But then we got hit with COVID-19, and so all of the gun ranges are closed. I haven't even put bullets in it yet, much less shot it.
So, Gwen, was this for like a hobby, in effect?
Yeah, I bought it as a hobby just to have a different hobby to get me out out and about and meet
Thanks.
New people, and that didn't work well.
Sorry. Well, good luck to you, Gwen. Thanks for the call. And that's a reminder, Timothy, a lot of people own firearms for a hobby or pastime, whether it's target shooting, even though the ranges are closed, or, of course, hunting.
Yes, I think that's certainly part of the market, but I think it's unlikely that that's what's driving the current spike in sales. I don't think that hobbyists have become overly enthusiastic because of the pandemic or protests or urban unrest. But Gwen makes an important point, which is that as a first-time gun buyer, she's been especially careful to make sure that she doesn't operate that weapon or start to use that weapon until she's had proper training. And one would hope that that's a widespread sentiment among first-time firearms owners. And if it is, I think that we're likely to see, you know, responsible use. I think people who are properly trained have a far less are far less risk of the types of accidents or misuse that we've seen with firearms. So I think, you know, as long as Gwen is an example of, you know, first-time firearms owners, we would be in a better position.
Thanks a lot for that call, Gwen, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Timothy Litton from Georgia State University's Law School, looking at a big jump in gun sales in the United States this year. Back to your calls now. Aaron is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have been an anti-gun person my whole life, probably more than anybody. My mom had two gun accidents in her house when she was young. We never were allowed to have guns in our house. And my 18-year-old nephew in Minnesota was shot to death 20 times by a 16-year-old who's now out of jail. He died. My nephew died. And I was always very against guns, but seeing all this left-wing violence by Antifa and Black Lives Matter pushed by Democrats is really, and pulling people from their cars and killing them, it's really making me want to get a gun and get proper training. I don't want to get a gun and not have proper training. But it's a frightening thing to see night after night in these Democrat cities, and they just let the people go. They don't prosecute them because they want to keep the violence up because they think it's politically good for them because they want to get Trump out.
Thanks a lot for the call. I'm going a little far afield there, Timothy, but he's not alone in that perception of chaos again.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of different stories that are driving firearm sales in the United States. And one of those stories is a story of social unrest and the unraveling of social fabric and the withdrawal of the police. And I think those sorts of fears are fears that traditionally the firearms industry has sought to capitalize on, if not also to feed at many points. I think a big part of the firearms industry's problem is that they actually make a product unlike most products, which generally does not wear out. So when you purchase a firearm, if it's well made, it shouldn't wear out ever. And so the real problem is that once you've sold, you know, everyone in America a gun, how are you going to sell more guns? And that's part of the reason that the marketing requires, you know, this constant feeding of these narratives. And one of the narratives is that we live in a time of great social unrest and insecurity, and that it's a group of people who don't have the best interests of the country at heart, and everybody needs to arm themselves in order to protect themselves against those sorts of elements in this society.
We should talk a little bit, I guess, about perception versus reality. We have seen an uptick in some violent crime and homicide in some American cities this year, but we've been at a low, right, in recent years compared to, say, the 80s and 90s. How much does it matter what actual crime statistics are versus our perceptions of them?
Well, as a general matter, people often have a fear of crime that is not well correlated with actual crime statistics. So this is pretty much, you know, a long-term phenomenon in the United States, that many times in the United States in the political cycle, people have a heightened sense of fear about crime, even though crime rates are going down. So I don't actually think there's generally much relationship between crime rates and the fear of crime. The crime rates are driven by, you know, policing practices and economic opportunity and a variety of other socioeconomic factors. And fear of crime is largely driven by the media. And the media responds to all sorts of things other than crime statistics when they talk about crime. What's featured on television? What sorts of programs are we watching? What are political leaders saying? So I don't think there's really much of a correlation between them. And the firearms industry is driven not by crime statistics, it's driven by crime perception.
Time for one more caller. Logan is with us in Green Bay. Logan, hi.
Hi. I'm totally against the use of guns. It was instilled in me by my dad and other members of the family that we should never own guns. Look at the slaughter in the United States. Americans are slaughtering each other. And yet the gun lobby wouldn't cede an inch. Thank you, sir.
Logan, thanks a lot for the call. And Logan, another point of view on guns, thinks we use them too much to solve our problems, as one of our earlier callers did as well, Timothy.
I think the idea of private firearms ownership is really a very American idea in many ways. It's driven by a narrative that says that, unlike many countries that have suffered from tyranny of overreaching governments, the United States, for all of its problems, whether it's been slavery or economic inequality, has never really had a tyrannical government. And I think a lot of people chalk that up to the idea of widespread private firearms ownership. And I think it's a very big part of the narrative of sort of the national story in many parts of the country where firearms ownership runs high. I know that I live in Georgia, and it's a very big part of the narrative here outside of Atlanta and north and south and rural Georgia areas. So I think that, you know, for many people, it's just hard to understand why Americans are so wedded to the idea of private firearms ownership, but it's very much part of the American story for many Americans.
Timothy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Timothy Litton is a professor of law at Georgia State University. His books include Suing the Gun Industry. He was with us to talk about a big jump in firearm sales in the United States we've seen so far this year. Coming up, we'll learn more about the state of our federal deficit and some recent findings on key programs like Social Security, a new report out on those topics from a key congressional watchdog agency. A lot of big numbers when it comes to how much money the U.S. is in debt. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, it's a weekly installment of personal financial advice. Get some great suggestions and join in with your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released its latest report on the state of the federal budget. The findings may not have been surprising, but they still raise some concerns. According to the CBO, the U.S. government will have its largest annual budget shortfall ever at more than $3.3 trillion when the fiscal year ends on September 30th. The shortfall was expected in large part because of government spending in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The CBO also outlined shortfalls in funding for various government programs, one of the most significant being Social Security. The CBO says the Social Security Trust Fund would be depleted by about 2031 without congressional intervention. That would lead to cuts in benefits. Thomas Kemp is a professor and the Economics Department Chair at UW-Eau Claire. Thomas, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, what's your reaction to this latest report on the deficit? Again, not surprising, but some pretty big numbers here.
Yeah, absolutely. They are some pretty big numbers, and they sure can look a little bit scary, you know, at first glance, but really not that surprising given the really slowdown in the economy resulting from the coronavirus, and then also the increase in government obligations as it has to pay out more for folks on various means-tested programs.
And let's talk a little bit about pre-COVID. We already saw annual deficits creeping up some because of some changes to tax laws and things like that. Increases in deficits you don't usually expect to see when the economy is doing well. What did you make of that before this pandemic started?
Yeah, well, so there was some pretty unconventional policy coming out of the government. You know, prior to COVID, we were seeing actually increases in federal spending accompanied by decreases in taxes, which is sort of the opposite of approach of what you normally see. Normally taxes are increased during prosperous times and spending comes down. And the result of that, prior to COVID, was a pretty red hot economy because, of course, the federal government was injecting a lot of expenditure into it.
Now we have this big downturn, this sudden downturn, unusually sudden because of the pandemic. Some economists have looked at, the trillions of dollars the U.S. government have spent so far and said, yeah, that's still not enough. Where do you fall on the spectrum of how much has been spent by the federal government versus how much the economy needs?
Well, how much has been spent is a matter of fact. So it is what it is. If you think of the size of the U.S. economy, however, though, it's over $20 trillion annually. So for the federal government to just continue spending what would have been spent by the private sector, it would have to spend far, far more than it is currently spending. The size of federal spending simply isn't large enough to keep up with the rest of the economy, which is why even though we have these, record-breaking deficits, the economy is still very, very sluggish by comparison to pre-COVID.
I want to turn to the overall debt in a minute. And can you give us a little economics 101? Because I will admit in the past in my life, I used deficit and debt interchangeably. They're different things. Separate them out for us, please.
Yeah, sure. Well, usually when I go in and people find out I'm an economics professor, they either give me a wink and say that was my favorite class or say they didn't learn anything. So that's A-okay. So the debt... Well, let's start with deficit. The deficit is the difference between what the federal government is projected to take in a given year and what it's projected to spend in a given year. So you can kind of think of this as like your income in a given year versus what you're going to spend. If you're going to spend more than you're going to earn, then you have a deficit for that year. Now, the debt, when we talk about the debt, the federal debt, that is the accumulated past deficits. So it's all the deficits that have occurred in the past summed up. You can think of that as like your personal debt. You may have a mortgage on your house. It's an obligation you owe onto others. It didn't occur all in one year. It's going to occur over many years. That is debt.
We're talking to Thomas Kemp, professor and economics chair at UW-Eau Claire, looking at a new report on the U.S. deficit, the overall debt, and how it could affect spending. Now, with that debt, the overall amount the United States owes, in effect, Thomas, people compare that to the overall size of the economy, the GDP. They look at that ratio, the debt to GDP, and now people are saying, this report's saying, in not too long, in just the next year or two, we're going to hit a point where that ratio is basically 1-to-1. The debt is about equal to the size of our overall economy. We haven't been there since World War II, when we had some pretty good reasons to spend a lot of money. Is that a meaningful ratio? Is that something that should freak us out at all?
It has meaning. It's something we should consider. I mean, if you think of using the analogy that I mentioned a few minutes ago, if you have a household income of $60,000, and then you also have $60,000 in total debt, that gives you a bit of a snapshot of your financial picture. It of course depends what the debt is on, and it depends what your future income is going to be. And so it is to some degree. I don't want to overemphasize that analogy, but to some degree, it's appropriate for the United States. So I wouldn't see it as a worrying ratio. In other words, given everything that's going on, it's not even in the top 20 things that I'm going to worry about this week. We shouldn't focus too much on it. We should focus more on the question of what we're spending on. Just as you would too. If you're going to borrow a bunch of money to throw a big party for your friends, that might not be money well spent. But if you borrowed the same amount of money to say get a good education or invest in a growing business, that might be money well borrowed and well spent. It's not so much the amount that matters. It's what you're doing with it.
Well, there's the notion, I think, out there that, okay, if we owe this amount of money, someday we're going to have to pay for it. or it's, the debts will get called in or something. It'll lead to a catastrophic outcome. Or as politicians often say it, our children and grandchildren are going to be bearing this burden. Is there any truth to that?
Well, of course, there's some truth to it, but that's another analogy I certainly wouldn't push very far. The idea that there's a fixed quantity of money or something like that in society is a pretty serious misunderstanding of how the financial system works. So that's this idea that somebody's got to find the money somewhere. And similarly, the idea that people would cash that debt all in at once, there's very, very good reasons why that would not happen. For the most obvious would be that it's not in anybody's interest to do that. So, for example, if I were holding a bunch of federal government debt, if I were to cash that in, it would drive the market value of that debt down, which would obviously not be in my interest to do. So that's exceedingly unlikely eventuality. And then furthermore, if I did that, it wouldn't necessarily collapse the U.S. economy, and it wouldn't collapse the United States federal government. So not really something to worry about too much.
Right now, we're talking about the latest news about the federal deficit, a new report out. Our guest is Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair of the economics department at UW-Eau Claire. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the federal deficit or about the future of Social Security, which we'll get into in just a few moments? What do you think the government should do to shore up programs like Social Security? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the federal deficit and potential long-term impacts that COVID-19 could have on our economy. Thomas Kemp is with us, professor of economics at UW-Eau Claire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the size of the annual deficit here in the United States, about our overall debt? Or do you think we should be focusing more on spending to help recovery from the economic downturn? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to turn to another part of this latest information from the Congressional Budget Office, Thomas, about Social Security, saying that the Social Security Trust Fund could end up going away early in the next decade. And to be clear, that doesn't mean Social Security benefits go away instantly. That's just sort of the backstop account. What are your thoughts on that news?
Yeah, well, it's disturbing, and you could understand why it would get people worried and upset. Lots of folks count on their Social Security benefits, and it's not an issue that we should take lightly. Of course, the proposed changes and changes to the payroll tax, which is one of the main funding sources for Social Security, is in question at the moment. And how that is impacted will, of course, impact the eventual solvency of the Social Security Trust Fund. That said, it should be noted that if that fund were to be insolvent, that continued Social Security payments could be funded out of the general fund. So just because the account, the trust fund, could potentially be insolvent, that does not mean that there is no avenue through which to continue making, for the federal government to continue making payments to recipients.
I've heard the argument that Congress could and should do something now and sooner, and the sooner that things get resolved, the less traumatic things will have to be to fix Social Security down the road. What are some of the options, Thomas, that could be considered this year or next year to push back that date?
Well, there's a number of things that have been kicked around over the years. You know, maintaining the payroll tax, of course, would do a fair bit to maintaining the trust fund solvency for a period of time. At several occasions over the last multiple decades, there's been talk of removing the cap on Social Security. On the payroll tax. Right now, payrolls are capped. You don't pay Social Security tax beyond a certain amount. If you simply remove that cap, and you paid the same Social Security tax rate on all income, that would move the solvency off into the near indefinite future, certainly all of the listeners' lifetime and our own as well. So the options are, I mean, and that might sound like not a big deal, and I would agree. So the problem is not not some radically complicated problem, really.
Not radically economically complicated, but it seems politically complicated. I know you focus on economics, but is that really the stumbling block that people are reluctant to tinker with Social Security too much?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, we're moving out of my wheelhouse when we start talking politics here. I would say most of our economic problems are actually political problems and not really economic problems. But this is certainly not an economic problem and primarily a political problem, yes.
So what are you watching for next when it comes to the state of the American economy? We had this big drop when COVID-19 first started, had some recovery, but not full recovery yet. What are you watching for now?
Yeah, so the thing I'm watching is I'm looking for policy that works to maintain people's skills during this downturn. So a lot of us are, some of us are working too much, and a lot of us aren't working at all. And for those of us who aren't working at all, we want to make sure that those people's skills don't lapse as we move through this, so that when the economy recovers, and it will eventually recover, this COVID thing will end, that those folks are at that time quickly employable and employable in a way that's profitable for businesses. So we want to make sure that everybody's skill set maintains up to date through this. And that's what I'm keeping an eye on is policies that try to do that.
Let's bring on a caller now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say that I absolutely think that we should be spending more to get ourselves out of the rut. You know, I don't think we're quite there yet. But I also think that we need to be doing that spending in a very intelligent way. Like, if we're going to be subsidizing companies, great, but let's make sure it's the companies that actually need it rather than, say, Amazon, Walmart. You know, the larger companies can fend for themselves, but the small mom and pop shops, they absolutely need more assistance.
John, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Thomas, what John had to say, target that spending to smaller businesses that might be in basically sink or swim situations right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I concur. You know, anything we can do to keep businesses up and running, anything we can do to keep employees' skills up to date, that's a solid investment compared to other possibilities. So yes, I would agree.
Now, early on with the big package in particular, the $3 trillion package, I think there was some agreement in Congress that, yeah, we might be able to do this better. We might be able to fine tune it, but that would take time. Faster was better at that point. Do you see kind of a more thoughtful consideration of future spending now, or do you see like a better targeted approach coming down the pike?
I see a lot of good ideas, and I see a lot, hear a lot of talk. I haven't seen a lot of action, and so it's difficult for me to know what to think. I have to believe that a lot of folks, myself included, are pretty frustrated by the relative inaction for quite some time out of the federal government, and I would really like to see some more progress towards some of these things we've been talking about. I mean, there's a lot of folks out there right now who are having a hard time with things, businesses that are, you know, just trying to hold the doors open for another few weeks, you know, workers are out of work. I would really like to see some more consideration given to those folks. And
briefly, as we wrap up, Thomas, are we going to be feeling the impacts of this economic hit for a long time?
Well, it's always hazardous to predict the future. But I think it's far more likely than not that the effects of the COVID event are going to be with us for some time. It's going to be, I think, a few years at least before we're back to economic normal. Hopefully we're all back to health normal well before then, but I think we're going to be in this for a little while.
Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Pleasure.
Thomas Kemp is a professor and department chair of the economics department at UW-Eau Claire. He joined us today to talk about the latest report from the Congressional Budget Office that found that the federal debt will outpace gross domestic product maybe as soon as next year. Also news that the Social Security Trust Fund could run out of money in roughly a decade. In a pandemic, political candidates have to find creative ways to get people's attention and to make contact with voters without putting anyone at risk. As Rob Mentzer reports, those constraints have made this political year like no other, and candidates at all levels are figuring out how to campaign in the COVID-19 era.
Lee Snodgrass wants to campaign safely. She doesn't want to contribute to spreading COVID-19, but she also really wants to win her assembly race in the Appleton area and to help her Democratic Party win more votes up and down the ballot. And she knows this fundamental rule of politics.
Voter contact is how you get votes.
The pandemic brought a halt to in-person events of all sorts in March. But in the months since then, campaign rallies and door-knocking political candidates have returned, or some of them have. In Wisconsin, it's mostly Republicans who are doing in-person campaigning. Snodgrass is one of a relatively small number of Democrats to have held in-person events, and they don't look much like the usual political chicken dinners.
Hi, I'm Lee. Hi, Lee. I'm John O'Boyle.
John, nice to meet you.
On a warm evening in mid-August, Snodgrass hosted a group of a dozen supporters on a walking tour fundraiser called Pollinators and Politics. Israel Del Toro, a biology professor at Lawrence University, talked about green spaces and urban beekeeping in Appleton.
And so we have four beehives here. You can see honeybees are pretty mild if you stay at where you guys are.
The event is outdoors. Everyone wears a mask and keeps their distance, but it's still an event. Snodgrass says politics aside, some people appreciate having something they can do that's social but still safe.
We have had to be really, really creative about how we gather because we want to make sure that we're doing it safely. And also, we want to make it fun. I mean, we were just laughing the other day about how the fun bar is really low these days. And so doing things like this that people maybe wouldn't have showed up at usually are really interested to do now.
And both parties have gotten creative. Supporters of President Trump held boat parades all around the state. Both political conventions had drive-in movie-style watch parties. Republican Representative Scott Krug, who represents the Wisconsin Rapids area, says he isn't doing many of the traditional election year events, but he's still going door-to-door a little.
Between now and November, I just want my work to speak for me more than me trying to guess if I should be knocking on everybody's door. I mean, I'm still going to do some door knocking, and I'm going to wear my mask and go knock on a door and back up and ask if it's okay to talk. I mean, you never know, but I still have to talk to voters regardless.
The two parties have taken very different approaches. All seven Republican candidates for Congress in Wisconsin held or participated in in-person events over the summer and posted about them on social media. None of the state's eight Democratic congressional candidates advertised in-person campaign events, though several participated in marches or outdoor protests held by others. The contrast is also clear at the top of the ticket.
In 78 days, we're going to stop the radical left. We're going to win the state of Wisconsin, and we are going to win four more years.
That was President Trump at a rally in Oshkosh in August. He and Vice President Mike Pence have each visited Wisconsin multiple times this year. Until last week, Democrat Joe Biden had not. Then on Thursday, Biden visited Kenosha.
When America has set its mind to something, it's never, 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 never failed when we put our minds to and we do it together.
Biden hasn't held any large events since the pandemic began. He met privately with the family of Jacob Blake, who was shot by police in Kenosha. Then he wore a mask while he spoke at a church in the community. Attendance was limited to a couple dozen people. It was his first visit to Wisconsin this year, but given Wisconsin's status as one of the nation's most closely divided swing states, it might not be the last. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a yoga instructor shares advice on feeling better and more confident about our bodies and overcoming the challenges of negative self-image. That's coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next on Central Time, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then when a coronavirus vaccine is ready, who should get it first? A medical ethics expert joins the show to tell us what goes into that decision. And you can share your answer to that question over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.